Hi, welcome to the HTA podcast. We tend to think of architecture as something that's mainly for looking at. We visit buildings, we look at them, we decide if they're beautiful or ugly, whether they're good architecture or bad. For many people, maybe most people, looking at buildings is the only way they consciously engage with them. But what if looking at buildings were the only way you couldn't engage with them? What if you experienced architecture only through your fingertips, the soles of your feet, on the surface of your skin, in your ears and through your nose? How would you navigate that? How would you pull those fragments together and form an understanding of place? That's what I want to explore today. My guest is a writer, theater artist, voice teacher, traveler, pilgrim, travel writer, who also happens to be blind.
My name is Alex Bulmer. I grew up in the country as a sighted girl, working on farms, collecting maple syrup, helping pigs give birth, so a very nature-centered, very sensory-rich upbringing. And at the age of 21, I was diagnosed as having an eye condition called retinitis pigmentosa. And the doctors told me at the time that I would be blind within 5 to 50 years, which is a bit of a wide highway to know what's coming. At first, I thought, on their advice, I needed to change my ambitions in life. I wanted to work in theater, and they said nobody wants to see a blind woman tripping across the stage. Very nice. And I considered other careers for about 2 weeks and then decided, no, I have to follow what I really care about, what makes me curious and passionate. And so I stuck with theater, but I decided to train as a voice teacher as well as an actor. I'll fast forward to say I have spent over 35 years in the profession as a writer and an actor and a teacher, both in Canada and the United Kingdom.
I want to ask you about your experience of places and especially buildings. And I know you've done a lot of travel, you've done a lot of travel writing. You've lived in England, you've traveled in Germany, you've traveled in Spain. If I tell someone I'm going to go to Spain, the first thing they're going to ask me is, oh, what are you going to see?
Yeah.
Now, yeah. That question is not relevant to you.
Yeah.
So can you characterize what you do instead? I mean, so many of our assumptions about travel, about our experience of the world, about what we get out of that experience, make the assumption of sight.
Mm-hmm.
And when that assumption is removed, say when you go to a building, what takes its place?
Probably the first thing, or the first two things, very close together, would be temperature and sound. Like a room has a sound, even if there's nothing, you know, there's no human voices or any kind of manufactured sound, but a room still has a sound. So this room that we're sitting in right now, we're sitting in my apartment, sounded completely different when I first moved in. Like, I've only been in this apartment for, I don't know, 7 months or something like that. And when I first walked in here, and there was nothing in here, and people will understand what I'm talking about. They know what it's like to walk into an empty apartment or an empty house when all the furniture is gone. It has a completely different sound than when you've got furniture in there. And it's not just When the furniture's in there and you think, oh, it's so nice and it feels like home. And yeah, it feels like home. It feels like home. It doesn't just look like home. It actually does feel like home because those sound waves are moving differently with all the furniture and the soft cushions and, you know, the paintings on the wall. So you are getting a visual sensation, but you're also hearing, you're taking in sound that is being absorbed in a very different way because of what's in the room. So yeah, people don't go into a library and say it feels like a library, but it does. Just to me, I went into the Runnymede Library I discovered it about 3 weeks ago. I was walking along Bloor Street, just really, I'd had enough with the sounds around me and the noise of the traffic, the behavior of humans in a busy city, and I just wanted to go inside somewhere that would ground me. And my phone app told me I was in front of a library, so I thought, oh, perfect. So I walked up the stairs, and I had quite an awkward time finding the door, and I was a little worried on the stairs because I couldn't find a railing. So the entry to the space was not particularly inviting, but I was determined to get in there. And as soon as the door closed behind me, I was so aware that the sound in this space was unlike any building I had been in for a very long time. There's nothing that is tinny. It doesn't sound like things are echoing. I have a sense in my ears that there are boundaries, actually. So the sound doesn't go on and on and on. But so it feels held, and therefore I feel held. That's kind of how it feels. You feel held by the sound in the room. And then I very quickly am aware of the sound of the floor under my feet. And whatever my hand first engages, that gives me my first impression, you know? And that's the other interesting thing about being blind, is that, yes, acoustically, you're getting a 360 around you. So acoustically, it's a very big picture. But other than that, it's down to the amount of centimeters or inches that my feet pass. So I don't know, maybe my feet are 7 inches. So it's, you know, 7 inches underfoot, and the size of my hand. That's the space. Other than the sound, that's it. So that doorknob and that touch of the door, you know, that initial touch of the door, that's the building at first.
That's so interesting. And some of what you say makes me think of tactility. Does tactility play a very significant role?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh, yes. For different reasons. One, it's a very pleasing experience to touch fabric. It's not pleasant to touch metal. It just isn't. I think visually, I've had furniture described to me that is metal and is very modern, and apparently it can look really great. It feels terrible. To sit on a metal chair is so unpleasant. It's cold, usually. The temperature is usually cold. It's not pleasant to the hand. Or really, under the legs and butt. You know, it is much nicer to engage with fabric. And I feel similarly about leather. I mean, for a while I was buying leather furniture primarily because I have a dog. And so thought, well, you know, dog hair is easier to clean off leather. But I'm not buying leather furniture anymore. I'm sick. I want to feel. I want that fabric experience. And then the other thing about tactility is not only from a kind of aesthetically pleasing perspective, but from a functional perspective. I use objects to tell me where I am in space. And having tactile reference points is so important. And I did find one of the first things I looked for when I was in this library was I was very conscious of the rug underneath my feet, and I thought, well, I'll stay on the rug until I get to the edge and then try and figure out, like by listening, oh, it sounds like somebody's talking over there. So I walked towards the voices, assuming, and I was right, that there would probably be a counter of some kind. So as soon as I found that counter, then I used the counter to trace my way towards the voices. And I've been in other buildings where I'm just so thrilled that as soon as I get in the door, there's, I guess, a kind of a ledge or a shelf. And once there's a shelf, I can use the edge and trace. And that's a very handy piece of information.
I want to move back for a moment to the subjective experience of architecture and space and place, because it's something you've talked about on a number of occasions, and I'm thinking of your trip to Freiburg Cathedral or your walk on the Camino de Santiago. Can you recall a particularly memorable place? Could be a building, or it could be a public square, or some particularly memorable, sort of singular place. And the metaphor that immediately comes to mind, of course, is deeply inappropriate, because I was about to say, can you help us see it through your eyes? But again, that just shows how our assumptions about sight are embedded in the way we speak every day.
Yes.
But help us perceive it through your experience.
Yeah. I remember stepping out of a car in Nashville, Tennessee. And I stepped out and there was music everywhere. And as my friend and I walked down the street, each building pumped out a different song, different music. So each building became evident to me through my ears. It's like, oh, okay, now we're a little bit bluesy here in this building. Oh, this building's a little bit more rock and roll. Okay, here is country. And so, although I didn't know what the architecture looked like, I immediately got an understanding of some kind of mood, vibe, energy, just from listening. And I do remember that moment being like something I don't think I'd ever experienced before, because it was everywhere. I think I described it in a show, Perceptual Archaeology, as dominating my ears the way the Rocky Mountains dominate the eye. It was everywhere. That I'd never experienced before. And then it happened again when I was in Memphis and we went to Beale Street. And again, the same thing. Music absolutely everywhere. So that was something that really struck me, and I don't think I've experienced anything quite like that since. In terms of a more natural setting, the whole Camino experience, it's hard for me to pick one place from another, because for me, it was the entire experience that was so remarkable, because I walked the whole way. Therefore, I understood what I'd been through, what I'd passed through. And I don't get that when I'm in a car or on a train. I can feel my body is moving, but I'm not getting really, the sensory experience is the vibration of the car, the vibration of the train kind of going, you know, the rocking of the train. That's the world. I am not engaging with beautiful landscapes out the window. And so to walk an entire 100 and I can't remember how long, 28 kilometers of space, knowing that I have smelt the whole way. I have listened the whole way. My feet have engaged with all the terrain, so I know what's up, where it goes down, where it's pebbles, where it's earth, where it's pavement. It added up to a full sense of travel that I don't think I have had since I lost my sight.
And that was largely something you experienced literally through the bottom of your feet.
Yeah. And it was a sound thing and a smell thing and a temperature thing. And I didn't need to see any of it. I don't think there was a moment that I was sad that I couldn't see, because it was so, everything was just so clear. Most of it, actually, to my surprise, was the natural world as opposed to walking through cities. We spent a lot of time in forests, in fields, or, you know, long stretches of, you know, country roads, and then coming up to a little village that somebody's voice would call out, and there might be a grape to pick off a vine, but the sensory experience was so rich. Yeah, I don't think I've encountered something like that on that scale. I mean, it was just epic.
Alex mentioned that the Camino was also a smell thing. So I asked her, do buildings smell?
Yes, they do. They really do. Slightly embarrassing, but the liquor store. I know when I'm in a liquor store because it smells like no other building. I think it might be a combination of the number of boxes and bottles that pass through.
So it's not a liquor smell?
No. It doesn't smell like liquor at all. No. Nope. It's not a liquor smell. I think it's bottles and boxes. It's a very particular smell. I wish I could describe it. It's not cardboard necessarily. It's kind of like, oh man, if it had a taste, it would taste a bit metallic. And maybe, I'm now thinking, I wonder if, and I have a feeling this might be true, I wonder if the shelves in liquor stores are metallic, or if there's quite a lot of metal around. Obviously cafes very much smell like cafes.
Right.
Definitely libraries smell. And I love that smell. It's got an aged smell to it. I'm trying to think of things that are unexpected, like obviously hospital smell. And I'm just trying to think if there's some others that are a little less expected. Well, everybody's house smells.
Does everybody's house smell the same? Or?
No, everybody's house smells different. I would say it's largely due to whatever's being cooked. But also, again, you know, the amount of soft fabrics, you know, smells get absorbed in those fabrics, and probably maybe the location of the house in terms of a busy street. I think it's mostly cooking.
Okay, I guess it could be animals in some houses.
True. Actually, that's true. I'm sure that my apartment smells a bit like my dog. And yeah, if people have cats, you know, you can pretty much tell if somebody has pets.
It's interesting because the different smells you're describing, you know, there's some, you mentioned dirty smells and loving the smell of a library. I mean, some of these smells are what we would think of as nice, pleasant smells.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are what we might describe as sort of stink. But
yeah.
I'm wondering if that distinction becomes less important. It's not so much this is a nice smell, that's not a nice smell, as these are all bits of information that I can use.
That's such a good question, because, like I said, I just moved into this building fairly recently, and just outside my door is the garbage chute. And I thought, oh no, I'm living next to the garbage chute. That's going to be horrible to go out in the hallway every day and walk past the garbage chute. Now, there may have been a couple of times in the last 6 months or so where I have taken my Febreze and gone in there, but I actually don't mind it. I think I find it a little bit interesting, and you would definitely traditionally describe it as a stink. But I think your question is so smart because, yeah, it's stinky, but it's very clearly right next to my door. And there's something comforting about that. There's something really reassuring that I don't need to see in order to know where I am. And that is a very, you know, if you, disorientation, I think, is one of the most horrible, vulnerable things, you know, not knowing where you are in space, like the sense of being lost. That's a scary experience. Sighted people understand that. Like, people don't like to get lost. Mm-hmm. Like, sighted people get lost all the time. It's, you know, and so I'm used to that, but it's the recovery. You know, we all get lost. It's the recovery. And so when I had sight, if I was wandering around lost and I had sight, I could look around and pretty much figure out through like a large visual picture around me how to recover from that sense of disorientation. And when you don't have sight, it's the recovery is very challenging. So a smell is a great piece of that recovery if you're lost.
Right, I guess, especially if something like the garbage chute is a fixed reference point. It's yeah. sort of like the North Star. It's like, yeah. okay, I know where that is. That means I know where I am.
And that's right.
I mean, that's something, you're right, we tend to take that for granted. But if we lose that sense of security about where we are in space, it's very unsettling.
It's so unsettling. And it's those fixed points that are my friend.
Being blind in a world designed by and frankly for sighted people does leave you vulnerable. You've touched on that already.
Mm-hmm.
So what sort of qualities or features in a building or a room alleviate that vulnerability? Or the flip side of that, of course, is what kinds of qualities or features can make a space feel uncomfortable or even threatening or even dangerous?
I always say to people, this is a very general thing to say, but I can tell when I've been imagined and I can tell when I have not been imagined. Mm. So when have I been imagined? You know, when there's carpets that have been placed not just for their visual effect but for their information, like just over behind you, there's a carpet going down in front of my closet that leads to the bathroom. And I chose a color for the carpet that in my mind I really like and that I think goes nicely with the decor. But the placement of the carpet and the thickness of the carpet is very much information for me. When a carpet is in a room purely for its visual impact, it does nothing to certainly lessen the vulnerability for me because it serves no function. If a carpet is very wisely placed in front of doorways or stairways or is placed and cut in such a way that it is also giving directional information, then my sense of vulnerability is lessened because I feel I've been imagined. I was recently in New Jersey at the Seeing Eye Dog School, which is where I got my beautiful doggie. And I was so struck at how safe I felt and how my body was relaxing in the building that I was in because everything had been designed and imagined for a blind person. Like every carpet I knew was there, not for sighted people, even though I'm sure they chose nice carpets so that looked good, but every carpet gave directional information or information that you were at a particular doorway. Those sorts of things, when you feel imagined, and this isn't just for blind people, anybody who feels imagined is going to feel welcomed. And I suppose I often tell students of mine, in theater students, when we think about accessibility, accessibility isn't just for me. Everybody has access needs. It's just that some people have their access needs met. So sighted people who walk into a building, chances are there's lighting and it's on. That's because they've been imagined. And so they feel welcome. I need those carpets. And also, getting back to this idea of smell, if there are live plants in specific spaces, like not, again, not just for their visual impact, but if there's a plant that has a nice, that sends off a fragrant, and most plants do if they're of a size, and it happens to be close to where the washroom door is, that's great, because then I know, oh right, there's the plant, so the washroom door is coming up soon. Also, if tracking, using your hands to track through a space, if you're constantly coming into contact with furniture while you're tracking a wall or tracking a ledge or tracking something with your hands, and you're every few feet you're hitting something, then you haven't been ima I haven't been imagined. So it's those sorts of things where you think about where the architect and the designer, the interior designer, has placed objects both for their visual aesthetic but also for directional information. My sense of vulnerability is definitely less.
That's so interesting in a couple of ways, because it wouldn't occur to most people that you can turn a space through judicious placement of things like plants and carpets into a tactile map of what's
Yes,
there.
that's
And
right.
whether you do that or you don't do that can make an enormous difference, transformational difference, to your ability to use the space.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you actually mentioned this notion of a tactile map, because you're completely right that you can turn a space into a map. You can also create a tactile map when that is at, the entrance of a building, especially depending on how big the building is. Those can also be really useful because you get to have the space in your hands. I describe seeing as being immediate. I know neurologists would say, well, it's not immediate. There's actually a process. And it's like, I know, okay. But it's nearly immediate, or it certainly feels immediate. And the big picture-ness of it feels very quick. Whereas with blindness, I sometimes describe blindness as having its own time zone, because it is a process. It takes time. And you gather information over a period of time in order to develop a fuller concept, which maybe in architectural terms is what we would call place. So I think of buildings as space first. When I was sighted, I could turn space into place in a very short amount of time. Space was place pretty much after I'd had a look around. With blindness, the amount of time between space and place is much, much, much greater. So this thing we call a tactile map, as in something that is actually created, that is at the entranceway of a building, that can really help turn space into place, because in your hands you can get the full picture, and then off you go to experience it in real time. I love tactile maps if they're designed well. If they're overwhelming and have just like a ridiculous amount of information, then they're useless. But I think the best tactile maps are the ones that focus on how to turn space into place. And You don't necessarily have to have every single detail to do that. I think it's more about understanding the bigger frame and the frame of the architecture, which really helps.
The other thing you said, talking about that, that really struck me is about the broader issue of accessibility and the fact that accessibility, access, isn't simply about whether you can see or whether you can't see, whether you're in your wheelchair, in a wheelchair, or whether you can walk. It's a universal question of who can use this place and who cannot. And that's a function of what you called imagining, who's being imagined when this place is being created and who isn't being imagined.
Yeah.
And that is such an interesting way to put it, because of course that's simply a choice. There's nothing unavoidable or inevitable about it. It's choices people make at a certain stage of designing a space, decorating a space, laying it out, that sort of thing. Although I suspect a lot of people aren't aware of the magnitude of what they consider to be small decisions in that process for some people.
Yes. The magnitude of small decisions. They're small, I suppose, for those whose access needs are regularly met.
So small, there's small decisions for those who have been imagined.
Exactly.
For those who have not been imagined, they're really consequential.
Yeah.
Because I guess the way to increase accessibility is simply imagine more people.
That's right. I have titled many a talk and workshop, Imagine Beyond the Assumed. Because when I'm asked, where do I start? You know, accessibility, inclusion, it's so overwhelming. How do I start? And I say, the first thing you start, imagine beyond your assumptions. So that, you have to have two things going on there, I guess. What are you assuming? Who are you assuming is going to come? Who is in the room right now? Who's not? Now imagine everybody else. And that, I think, takes you on a journey that has so much possibility. And, you know, I would imagine that architects are constantly imagining, but they're probably imagining the same people.
Right. And so what's really needed here, I guess, too, is a lot of empathy. You've got to be able to put yourself in the position of people whose assumptions and experiences of the world are different from your own, and that requires empathy.
Yes. Yes. It does require empathy. It probably also, at best, requires conversation and relationship building. Because, you know, empathy is a wonderful, is it a virtue? Yeah, I guess it is a virtue. But the risk of relying on empathy is that you may be bringing too much of your own experience to that empathy. And so asking other people to talk about their experience, not necessarily so you empathize with them, but so that you actually listen and understand, not maybe necessarily on a feeling level, but on a more cerebral level or on a functional level. Because people can empathize with me. I had this conversation with somebody, and I wish I could remember the context, but I remember him saying, I guess I just need to walk in your shoes. And I said, yeah, you could, but really what you need to do is just listen to me and respond to the fact that I need a screen reader in my computer. You actually don't need to go home and empathize with me. You just need to get me a screen reader for my computer. Otherwise, I can't work here. So I think it's both.
Right. So I guess empathy is nice and heartwarming, but empathy without education doesn't actually solve a lot of problems.
Yes, I think that's very true. I think you need both. You know, because I think it's the empathy that is the wonderful sort of motivating factor. But you have to learn from other people's experience.
In part two of this podcast, We'll learn from Alex's experience by visiting a building with her, one that she's never been to before. We'll learn how she navigates and makes sense of this new space. My name's Peter Kaufman. My guest has been Alex Bulmer. The music is by Oliver Schroer.